Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My returning guest tonight is award-winning author of books on history, landscape, and great literature, Adam Nicholson. And tonight we're talking about his new book, Bird School, A Beginner in the Wood. Adam, it's such a pleasure to talk to you again. We talked before about tide pools. This is a whole this is a whole different thing. I really loved this book. Your whole sort of voyage begins with a dead raven. Talk about that.
Yes, I was in Crete in the Eastern Mediterranean, the Greek island, with my wife Sarah, and driving along, and we saw on the side of the road this dark, inert form, and stopped the car and got out, and it was indeed a raven. A raven had been shot, I think, and had slightly bloodied bill. But it was really the first bird I'd ever really looked at carefully, and I was kind of overwhelmed by the beauty of this thing. I mean, the bird itself had gone, you know, with a dead bird. The bird isn't there. Whatever it was as a bird is no longer there. It's just this, I remember thinking it was like a kind of derelict and abandoned house, or just recently deserted house, with these amazing structures and this extraordinary kind of primeval power about it. And I thought, why on earth have I not attended to these creatures before? I'd spent my life really rather indifferent to birds, and I have had great friends who are birders, and they've always said, you know, there's a woodlark singing above us, or you know, have you seen the dipper in the stream there? And I never really bothered to look. And suddenly confronted with this incredible dead creature, I felt ashamed of that. I felt you know, this was symptomatic, actually, of lots of things in our culture, that we have been indifferent, especially to the little birds, the non-dramatic birds, the birds that surround us every day in our lives. And as a result, you know, we've really abused them. And in the Western world, in the industrialized world as a whole, they've suffered these catastrophic declines. And so it was a kind of double thing. It was my own failure to attend to these miracles, really, and also thinking, well, I have, and the world has, and come on, let's pay closer attention. And that's really what this book is about. It's a grand reproach to myself for a lifetime of indifference and an attempt to get close to birds, the birds around me here at home.
And this is where you come up with the idea of building, for you, a bird school on Perch Hill Farm. And this idea was really captivated me, because you didn't want to just build an observatory. You wanted to build something that you called an absorbatory. And let's talk about Perch Hill Farm first. Paint a picture of Perch Hill Farm.
Yes, so I've lived here on this small farm in the south of England, in Sussex. It's a 90-acre farm. It's exactly like many, many farms in this part of the world. It was always been a small family farm, surrounded by woods, with woods in it too, with streams, and I think it's 17 little hay meadows. And very much the kind of place which the yeoman farmers, as they were called, of England lived, a kind of a really, really beautiful kind of construct in which a family could survive. Now, I went and found all the documentation for it, going back to the early 15th century is the first mention of this farm, when the two of the fields were sold here, just, I think, 4 or 5 years after the Battle of Agincourt. And then, and incredibly, and then I think it's 51, the names of 51 different farmers who lived here are there in the records, each with their, you know, large families and people working on the farm at the moment. It's a place that sort of seems now to me to belong to this a really thick pelt of humanity, who has kind of engaged with it as a place to grow food, but also as a place in which nature has thrived. It's a kind of farming, you know, until modern industrialized farming was extraordinarily good for the natural world. It's a very, very mixed mosaic of open field, tall grass in the hay meadows, woods which were sometimes cut down and young woods would spring up from the cut trees, you know, the coppicing technique. And so a very, very mosaic-y and complex little world, little microcosm of I think really how we should be. You know, it's not the great fad in this country now is for rewilding everything, for abandoning everything anyone that's ever done to a landscape and letting nature just surge back in, which is all very well maybe in part. But the great thing here is that this is an extraordinary medieval structure, which is both great for human beings and great for the other creatures that can live in it. And so I kind of only really clocked this recently, that it's not just a pretty place, it's an amazingly biodiverse place. And so to be indifferent to birds here is even more of a crime than anywhere else.
I love how the fields are named. That's not true here in the United States. But you decide to put your...
What do fields get called in America?
Fields.
Do they get called 1, 2, 3, and 4?
Yeah. And so you decide don't go there. You decide to build...
It can't be true in Massachusetts or...
Well, realize that most of the fields are now forest.
Yeah, I know, abandoned. I've walked through those.
Yeah, yeah. Stone walls are everywhere where there used to be fields, and now there's forest. But you decide to build your structure in hollow Flemings.
Yeah.
Now, where did that name come from?
Well, I think Flemings, from what I could work out from the documents, there was a guy who farmed that end of this farm. I think maybe a part of it, maybe called Fleming, or maybe actually was a Fleming. Lots of Flemings, that's people who came from Flanders in the Low Countries on the European continent. And anyway, so there are other fields here called Great Flemings and Little Flemings, and this is Hollow Flemings, because Hollow Flemings is very subject to landslips, which a lot of the farm is, in fact. And a stream just at the bottom of Hollow Flemings cut into the field about 25 years ago now, and the whole field slipped, and we had to abandon it. We couldn't get a tractor in there. The fencing was all, you know, in pieces. There's no way we could continue to take hay off it or graze animals in there. And so we just let it go. And in the I've got a frog in my throat. Too much biodiversity. So it's become... an extraordinary bit of kind of nascent wilderness, full of blackthorn and hawthorn and young ash trees, willow, alder, oak trees and hazels growing in it, with an amazing tangle of bracken and bramble all underneath it. So you can hardly get in there at all now. And of course, that is the kind of place that nature loves. Nature loves to hide. Great statement of Heraclitus in the pre-Socratic philosopher in 600 BC. And I only said nature likes to be hid. You know, nature does not like to stroll about like you see it on TV. It likes to hide. And so this completely dense thicket has become a place really thick with birds. So that's where I decided to build this shed on stilts, really. That's what it is.
It's a beautiful structure.
It's a lovely, lovely thing. A very great friend of mine, we've done a lot of work together, joiner down the road here called Nick Walsh, built it with me. My daughter, who's a young architect, she sort of drew up sketches for it. And it was a kind of family assembly, which is another great thing. You know, this wasn't a kind of me alone in the wood type thing. It was a great social thing we were doing. And so the structure is it's hexagonal. It's maybe, I think, about 10, 12 feet across, something like that, with a pointy roof and windows on all sides, right up in the trees. So the nearest trees are 18 inches from the windows.
Wow.
And then in the walls of it, we put 8 nest boxes, which you could get into if you're a bird, from the outside through different size holes for different size birds. And then, but the inner wall of those nest boxes, Nick made them of glass with a little door that you could close. And so if you're in the birdhouse, you can open the little door and see the birds nesting in the birdhouse. So bird school was occupied by me, my daughters, my wife, by Nick and his family, all of us sitting there. And then great tits, blue tits, marsh tits, all nesting in the walls of the thing. So there was one moment when we were all in there having a picnic lunch in there. And I think if you counted us and all the birds in bird school that morning, I think there was something like 45 creatures in this little shed. It was absolutely wonderful. And so in a way, this is what the observatory is about. You know, that most people think when you think, get interested in birds, buy a pair of binoculars and look at them from a long way away. But this was a way of kind of getting close to them, essentially by hiding in this shed.
Hiding in and among them.
Hiding in them. When you can hear, the lovely thing is that you sit in there and you hear them all just kind of scratching and cheeping in their little boxes all around you. And with the trees just outside, and I put some feeders in the trees, and so the life in the trees was absolutely vivid. And I think, you know, one could get quite highfalutin about this and say, the thing about an observatory is that it preserves the distance between the observer and the observed. And the thing about this kind of structure is, which kind of allows the other creatures almost an equal presence in the building and around the building, is that it begins to dissolve that distance between us and nature. You know, there's this great theory that our culture begins sort of in Mesopotamia in whatever it is, 10,000 BC, which, you know, people have called the great severing, the moment when a kind of slice comes down between us on one hand and nature on the other, in which the kind of pre-agricultural and pre-urban, obviously pre-industrial world, that sense of a kind of being distinct from nature is not there. You are all swimming in the same joint pool, and that kind of dissolving of the boundary, I think, is also what this is about. So no indifference and no severing.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My returning guest tonight is award-winning author of books on history, landscape, and great literature, Adam Nicholson. And tonight we're talking about his new book. It is special. Bird School, A Beginner in the Wood. Now, Adam, I just want to talk about some of the... First of all, your writing in every chapter is just a joy to read. But there's other features in this book. I want to make sure listeners know about it. Each chapter focuses usually on sort of one species of bird, one group of birds. And by observing these species, or about looking at these species, you also talk a lot about some aspect of their life, like singing, defending territory, migration. And there's a lot of references to other literature. But that's not all. At the end of the book, there's a section called Birds in the Garden by Sarah Raven, which is about plants to put into your land in order to attract birds. And finally, The Roll Call of the Birds of Fleming Perch Hill, which uses QR codes. And I used them in the book a lot. As a matter of fact, I used them to call in a raven that was flying over my house. And they work incredibly well.
I'm so pleased they do. I was very anxious about that.
No, they really do. So this is not just a single book. There's a lot of other features in this book. But let's go back to your bird school. I love the fact that the first bird that you noticed was a wren, Troglodytes troglodytes. Here we call it winter wren.
Yeah.
In Britain, of course, it's wren.
It's the only wren. It's the only wren we have here. You have something called a house wren, I think.
Right. And but the winter wren is much for us. is much more of a sort of more northern, more woodsy bird. I can't believe they're the same species. But the funny thing is, this wren just sort of moved in.
Yes. Well, I mean, it's this lovely name, Troglodytes, you know, means cave dweller, which is just such a brilliantly poetic thing for whoever. I don't know if that was Linnaeus or someone who named the wren there. Yeah, it moved in. So we built this shed on stilts, and I moved in, and it was winter. It was January, very, very cold, exceptionally cold for this country. So snow on the ground, very frosty. And I was just sitting in there, kind of, you know, think, right, okay, we built the shed, now what happens? And suddenly realized that this wren had taken up residence there too. And
how did it get in?
Right at the top of the sort of pyramidal roof, Nick had put this louver to aerate the building.
Oh, right.
It has a wood burner in it, but he just left the louver, and it has crept in through there. But it's very, very interesting then. Sort of, I started to look into the whole story of the wren, and the whole kind of biological story of the wren. And the wren is obviously a very, very small thing. I can't know. It's a few ounces, a tiny bird. And there is a benefit in being tiny, is you don't need actually to find much food to survive. You can do very well if supplies are low. But the hazard that comes with that is that you're very, very subject to cold. And in this country, I don't know about the winter wren in the States, but in this country, the population of wrens goes through extremely steep zigzag paths.
Yep, and it does here too.
In very, 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 very steep. I don't know, does that happen in the States too?
Well, with the winter, anyway, with the winter wren, it does. Because they try to hang on for a bit, and then they have to get further south.
Yes. So here, I mean, some are slightly migratory, but hardly migratory, and their populations crashed. 80%, 75% a decline in the wren population in this country in one bad winter. But then the wren's great secret is absolute lust. It's easily the most lustful bird going. And when the spring comes, it establishes its territory, quite a large territory, maybe an acre and a half, something like that. And all around the territory builds little nests, little stick nests. And maybe 7 or 8 of them in his territory is scattered around different parts. And then, when he's built his nest, he then finds female wrens flying by. And says and stands outside his cock nest and sings to her, sings essentially, look, this is a lovely nest I've made. Would you like to come and look at this one? And he then tours her around the 7 or 8 nests and says, well, here's another one. There's one over here. Would you like this one? And she then decides that she will take up residence if he's done it well enough, if she likes the look of what he's done. Because obviously the nest is a signal of how cool a bird he is, you know, how vital a bird he is. And she then literally feathers the nest and brings feathers and lines the nest and lays eggs in it. And so he's done very well. But then the cockwren, having settled her in there, his work is not over. And he continues to sing to passing female wrens and will say to them, well, look, well, I have 6 nests. Would you like to see nests 1, 2, 3, 5, 6, and 7? Unfortunately, number 4 is already occupied, and he can settle another wife in another nest. And so he doubles his outcome. And so his in terms of eggs and chicks, and so then the population zooms back up again. And so the wren, I thought, is just a magnificent companion to kind of come and find shelter with human beings in the winter, and then zip out in the spring to a summer just filled with sex.
There's so many birds that
don't you love a wren, though, Mike?
I love wrens.
They're so tiny, the way they fly with no pauses, you know, they don't have that kind of, you know, like a woodpecker or something, beats and then glide beats.
Oh no, they sort of buzz along.
It's almost like a bumblebee.
Yeah. Here they often are very low to the ground, and they just will buzz across the trail that you're on, and they go underneath rocks. I mean, they'll go underneath the rocks in the stone wall or underneath a log looking for food.
Well, I had some chainsaw trousers hanging up in the barn and went to put them on, and that in the pocket was a wren's nest. And then there was another nest in the chassis of the truck we used around the farm. So that had to go off to be serviced in the garage down the road. And it came back with the nest still in it, and then the wren continued using the nest even after the nest had been on a little journey of kind of 8 miles back and forth.
I want to at least
just
mention
the sheer zip of life these things have got. You know,
well, they're really amazing.
They're so alive.
Yeah, and they'll scold you, too.
Yeah, really? I haven't been scolded.
Oh, they don't like you if you're outside near where they're nesting. They'll give you a little bit of scold. Okay. There's so many birds that you write about. I just want to mention one more, because Eurasian robins. I've birded Britain before and other places in Europe and seen lots of robins. They always, first of all, they always look like they're stuffed or something. They have this black eye, and they always look like they're this absolutely delightful little peaceful bird. That it's a symbol of Christmas in Britain, but the Eurasian robin is actually sort of a fierce bird.
It's a very fierce bird, and I witnessed fights between robins. I mean, robins have been seen to kill each other. I've never witnessed that, but cock robins do have this extraordinary kind of cockpit behavior, and they stand there. Do you know this very odd thing that when you attend very carefully to a bird, the whole scale of its existence seems to enlarge in front of your eyes.
Yeah.
You had that experience?
Yeah, yep.
You know, when you look at them, you suddenly see this entire kind of Shakespearean drama being played out in front of you, with two robins just strutting around and waving their heads from side to side, almost like a kind of, you know, ancient voodoo doll. Yes, I mean, they are their ferocity itself. But they're also the great singers, you know, and unlike most birds, at this time of year, both male and female robins start to set up territories. And so the females hold territories over the winter. No one, I think, quite knows why. But it means, as literally as I was walking around the farm this morning, you could walk through. I mean, I can't tell the difference myself between female and male robin song, but this was a patch of robin land. This was another patch next to it, entirely kind of mapping out the whole farm. And there's a wonderful book by a Belgian philosopher, I think she's called Vincienne Desbray, in which she talks about us needing to understand what a bird's body is as something more than just that little feathered thing. And she says that really to understand what a bird in toto, the whole sort of the whole package of the bird is, one should think of the territory over which you can hear a bird's song as the bird's body. The bird is more than that little physical thing. It is the kind of envelope of assertion that the song creates around it. And so I'm an absolute addict of Merlin, the app now. and walk around thinking, oh, yeah, so this is not only a kind of area of the farm that is filled with this song. This, I'm almost walking through the robin's being as I pass through this. And I think that's just a very, very kind of beautiful but counterintuitive way of understanding what a bird actually is. It's not just this fragile little thing that, you know, can get hit by a car. It's a sort of great loud presence in the world. And of course, you know, when you start to think of other creatures in that way, one's own sort of domineering arrogance, I suppose you could say, necessarily diminishes in the light of that. You necessarily begin to think, what on earth am I compared to this? Could I really stand, you know, 40, 50 foot up in a tree and sing to the extent that people would say, oh, yes, I see, that's Adam's territory? I don't think so.
I think that's one of the lessons I learned from this book, too. Plus the fact you love in-between things, things that are not one thing or the other. That seems to come out in the book.
That's interesting. What do you mean by that?
We don't have time to talk about it because we're completely out of time. It's like we could wade in so deep in this book, and that's the fascinating thing for me, is that you've got a bird book that you can actually discuss.
Is that not usually the case?
No, it's not, Adam. It's mostly... I just love the fact that you brought in Love's Labor's Lost, Shakespeare's transcription of the call of the tawny owl is to wit to woo. That's been with me my entire life until I finally heard a tawny owl. There's so much we could talk about this book, but we're out of time. My returning guest tonight is award-winning author of books on history, landscape, and great literature, Adam Nicholson. And tonight we're talking about his new book. It is so worth to just sink into a chair and read this book. Bird School, A Beginner in the Wood. Adam, it's a pleasure.
Oh, thanks so much, Mark. You're a lovely interviewer.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.